Again, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers. My sobriety date's February 18, 2002. Central has been my home group since 1998. And I never gave up on coming. I just didn't quit drinking at first. And it kind of works better if you quit drinking and get a sponsor and do those things. So my life changed dramatically once I started doing that. And it continues to change every day. You know, this is a great home group, but I've been to groups, you know, pretty much all over the United States. And I can tell you that no matter where I go, I'm welcome. And that's what we do, is we welcome people no matter where they're from or how hard they're hurting. That's exactly what we try to do. And 4 years ago, I was living up in Georgia, and I got a phone call from a member that I'd never met telling me my little brother was in serious trouble down here in Florida. And I came back, and a month later, I held his hand while he died. And he died from untreated alcoholism. And so this month and next month are kind of, you know, months where I get kind of choked up. But one of the greatest things that happened was I got to meet our speaker. And I'm going to introduce him in just a second. The group just asked me to remind you to please turn off your cell phones and refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. And like I said, I met Phil during that period of time that my little brother was passing, and then he passed. And I got to be good friends with he and his wife. It was the first time I'd ever bowled sober. I can remember my first game was a 35, and I thought that was great because I finally got it out of those two little side areas. Now I bowl with a group from here on a regular basis, and I get maybe 75, and I think that's a good improvement for 4 years. But like I said, Phil's a great guy. He's got a great story, and why don't y'all give him a warm welcome. Phil?
My name is Phil. I am an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is October 28, 2003. My home group is a sobriety plus group. We meet every Saturday night at 8 o'clock. The place called the Eastside Club. It's 2017 North Golden Ride Road. If you're ever bored of coming here, come on down there. We get some really sick individuals that have gotten well in Alcoholics Anonymous come down and tell their story. Some of them are here tonight. I want to thank Jimmy for asking me to give a talk down here tonight. I want to thank Central Group for being here. If you like what you hear, thank God afterwards. If you don't, take it up with Jimmy. I look around and I go, wow, there's a few people here today. And, well, wow, you must all be drunks because you're not down at the fireworks. So, in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I was born in a little place, East L.A., Lower Akron, Ohio. And some of you may recognize that as being the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not recognize that as being the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous until I got sober. I recognized it as a place to get drunk. And I did that from an early age. I'm the youngest of five, mother and father, married till the day my father died in 2000. Neither one of them, as far as I can tell you, are alcoholics. They seem to be able to control and enjoy their drinking. I can tell you my other four siblings, they're suspect. My oldest brother is 13 years older than me, so by the time I was 6 years old, he was of legal age, getting out of high school. Around that time, Vietnam was winding down. But my older brothers had been involved in all the demonstrations up at a little place called Kent State University. And that was kind of the distinct difference in the family life that I had. I had a couple of parents that drank successfully, you know, one or two drinks and could stop. You know, I used to watch my mother. She'd have a drink and maybe have another drink. And by 11 o'clock at night, the news would be ending, and she'd pour almost that whole other drink out, you know. And it never dawned on me until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that isn't true with alcoholics. That only non-alcoholics drink that way. And so by the time I was 6 years old, I was stealing drinks off my brother, oldest brother's beer, Stroh's Bohemian, fine beer that they used to drink up there. My parents used to buy it because they thought their kids wouldn't drink it, and they found out different. And my brother thought it was cute, and I can tell you, you know, from 6 to 10, I wasn't going out to the bars. I wasn't going to the state liquor store, you know. I was stealing drinks here or there, but I couldn't tell you how I was drinking, you know. It was innocent. But I can tell you, by the time I was 10 years old, my distinct recollection is filling the old glass Skippy peanut butter jar from underneath my mom's cupboard full of a little bit of everything in their liquor cabinet, including cream de menthe and gin and brandy and, you know, all this crazy stuff, and going to the local lake with my buddy. And I remember going down to the lake and taking a pull on that thing, and it was nasty. And my buddy took a pull on it, and I think he took another pull on it, and that was it for him, and I finished it. And at the age of 10, I blacked out. It was my first time ever of blacking out, and I didn't know that that's what it was. I only know that because of the stories I was told afterwards. And I'll tell you, from the time that I was about 10 to the time I was finally of legal age, it never dawned on me that I wasn't supposed to be drinking, you know? Because by the time I became of legal age, I had been drinking so long, it just didn't take any effect on me, that it wasn't something that I was supposed to be doing until I was of age. So, you know, along the way, I did a lot of things that got in, you know, a lot of things that got myself into trouble. I had a problem taking things that didn't belong to me, and that was usually associated with drinking. And I tell you, I found out at an early age, it's hard to be a good criminal when you're bad drunk. That by the time I was about 14 years old, I was ending up in a place called the Dan Street Motel in Akron. That's a juvenile, like the JAC here, what we had up there. You know, my folks would go out of town and they'd leave me there for the 2 weeks they were gone. You know, keep them. And, you know, what I know today, you know, it played hell on my mother, and it did on my father because it played hell on my mother. But I tell you, they at least knew where I was at, and they knew I was safe. I know that from then till the time I was 19 years old, I got sentenced on my 19th birthday to 4 to 25 years in a place they called a reformatory. You know, I heard a guy share that, you know, for those of you that have been, you know what it's like. For those of you that haven't, you don't want to know. And for me, there was no reforming going on in there. There was a lot of other stuff going on in there. And for a scared, young, 19-year-old boy like I was, it was a place that few should ever want to be. But I can tell you, the first day entering into that place, I felt like that's where I was going to end up the rest of my life. It just felt like that's where I belonged. The stuff that I was doing, the way I was acting, and the things I was doing, just it seemed like that's where I belonged. And so, flash ahead, I eventually got out of that place, and I met my future ex-wife. She is the niece of my brother's wife in California. So, California, here I come. All right? The only problem was I took me with it. So I ended up in California, and I married that girl. And, you know, she came from a house of a couple alcoholics and basically raised herself and was on the streets by the time she was 15. But she got taken in by a Christian family, and she ended up going to college at a Christian university. And when I met her, she was still in school there. And when I showed up, she thought she was getting a different package. She thought she was getting a sober guy that was really going somewhere with his life. And what happens is that sobriety through incarceration works until you let me out. And then there I go again. So in a matter of weeks from the time that I got out to the time that I met up with her, I was back at it, you know, and I had brought all that stuff with me to California. And I'll tell you real short and quick, the next 8.5 years how our marriage went. She would successfully get up and go off to work and make a living, make some money, help pay the bills. I would come to, find a place to drink, maybe do some work, probably not. But one thing for sure, by the time she got home, I'd be drunk, blacked out, passed out. We'd fight. I'd black out, pass out. She'd get up the next morning, go off to work. I'd come to. I thought it was called waking up. And I'd do the same thing. And, you know, you can just write the next 8.5 years off like that. We were separated about 7.5 of those 8.5 years. It was just insane. And, you know, I never knew until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that she actually did love me. You know, I wasn't even aware of that. You know, I thought she was just a nag. And so what happened was eventually one day, because I had still a problem with taking other people's things, three really big guys showed up at her house. And we were living in South Lake Tahoe, and I thought it'd be a good idea to voluntarily commit myself at the Nut Ward at the State Mental Hospital in Reno, Nevada. That'd be a place where they couldn't get a hold of me. The problem with that is they don't let you out when you want. And that's where I found out about you guys. A couple of guys brought a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous into that place. And I heard the guy say that it was a disease, and I likened that to cancer. And I heard him say some other things, like go to meetings and get a sponsor, but I didn't do any of that other stuff. I mean, I went to meetings, but I was just looking for a way out. And after about 6 months, 1 month shy of the cutoff point of it ruining my drinking, somebody suggested I chair a meeting out there, and I thought that was a good idea, and I chaired the meeting. I left there, I went to the casino, and I stayed drunk for another 20 years. Sure. Yeah. That's how I drink. I'm well aware you guys don't do any drinking here. I had no point in coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not done drinking. But I can tell you, when I had done all the damage that I needed to do, not just in my life, but in so many other people's lives, you guys were here. So what happened was, I came home one day and I found out she left, and she took everything. She took all my stuff. She took the dog. I was most upset about that. And my family members pointed out that I couldn't take care of myself, let alone a dog. I thought they were being a little harsh. What happened was, though, I made this genius idea that I ought to put a couple thousand miles between me and her. See, when I was living in San Diego for a while with her, a friend of mine showed up and he said, you know, if you ever come to your senses and leave her, come to Cocoa Beach and look me up. Now, he'll tell you today that is not what he said. But I have a problem with perception, and that's exactly what he said. So what I thought was, now's a good time to point my car east, again, bringing myself along, and look up that buddy of mine. Well, I decided to stop up north and spend some time with the family over the holidays. It was about this time of year, and I ended up staying up there for a year. And my one older brother took me in, and I lived with him. And oh man, it was insane. The drinking found proportions like it hadn't been before. And so a year later, I arrive in Florida, and I end up at my buddy's place over 4th Street, Cocoa Beach. And it's a surfer apartment, you know. One of the windows is broken out. It's a two-bedroom place. There's like six guys living in it. You know, it's like, and they work all different hours, you know. Like, they're all like servers or whatever you can do to make a little bit of cash. And so I became drinking buddy. You know, and so I was always available for that task, and I thought that was an honor. You know, I thought that was a privilege to be that. So, I'm living there with my buddy, and I finally take a job with a guy, and I always took jobs with guys that drank like I did, and I get a job working for this guy, and my whole purpose working with this guy was to see how much earlier every day I could convince him to knock off work and go to the bar. So like, if when I started, it was like 2 o'clock. By the time I got done working with him, it was like 10 o'clock in the morning. I mean, we put like 2 hours in, and then we were off to the bar. And you know, he was the kind of guy that I was always getting a draw from. You know, a draw for, I get a draw, I'd work like Wednesday, Thursday, get a draw Thursday night, and then want a paycheck on Friday, you know. And so anyhow, eventually, I'm sitting at a pool bar at the Hilton in Indy Atlantic Beach, and that's where I met my current wife. She came up. She used to work with a buddy of mine, and she showed up, and she said, hey, what are you doing here? And I told her, you know, we were doing some work there. And then she immediately asked about my boss, and I said, oh, he's married and has kids, you know. nothing about him. I said, did you want to go out? And she said, yeah, meet me at Jamaica Me Crazy. Now, Jamaica Me Crazy was this party they had at the Hill or the Holiday Inn on Wednesday nights, and there'd be about 700 people would come to this pool reggae party. And so I agreed to meet her, and I got down there, and I got down there early, you know, like 3 o'clock in the afternoon I started drinking, and it doesn't start till 7 or 8 o'clock at night, but by 7 o'clock I was loaded, and by 9 or 10 I'm walking around still looking for her, and she didn't show up. So I stalked her, and the next day at her work, and she goes, oh, I thought you were kidding, and I explained to her how I hadn't been kidding. Anyhow, that started a relationship with a woman that drank just like I drank. She's today sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's way more sober than me. She's got a day on me, and that works well. And but she had a son at the time who was a teenager, and I knew nothing about teenagers and being a father figure, and let alone a husband figure. I had a track record that wasn't too impressive on that already. But I asked her to marry me, and she said yeah. And so we ended up getting married in 2005. And we were headed down to get our marriage license in Melbourne, and we walked into the place, and she goes, oh, by the way, I might still be married to my ex in Texas, and I have another son by him there. And without missing a beat, I just went, well, that's Texas, you know. So we got married. Well, I decided to start a business in competition with that boss that I drank with, and apparently I had signed a non-compete form with him, and then and in Florida, I guess they're kind of serious about those things. But he sued me, and I claimed I was drunk when I signed it, and apparently that doesn't matter in Florida. So we settled, and we ended up moving here to Orlando, my wife, her son, and I. And in 95, we got here, and the next couple of years, we were trying to put together a family household, you know, bad, with a couple of bad drunks, and the son was trying to do what he could to participate and be a part of it. And it was just tough. And what happened was in 2000, we had bought a house, and we were moving into it. And a couple guys showed up at our door and said, it was about 12 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, and they said, your son's been in an accident. He's at the hospital. And and we went down there, and he had already been helicoptered from East Orlando to Florida South, and he was in the hyperbaric chamber there. There had been a fire, and what happened was they told us that he had killed his girlfriend and tried to commit suicide and started a fire in the apartment that had happened. And 3 days later, October 27th of 2000, her son passed away. And you know, for the next 3 years, it was pretty dark in our household. It was pretty unmanageable, and life was very difficult. But eventually, a friend who happened to be a minister said, I can't help you, go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I met my wife, I still had that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that I had gotten 20 years earlier back in California. And I'd been carrying that thing around with me. And she, when we were first dating, she came to my apartment. She went into the little dresser. She goes, what's this? And I go, oh, that was some friends. And a couple of days later, I was at her house, and I looked in her nightstand. She had the 24-hour day book, and I was like, what's this? She goes, oh, that was my mom. She was an alcoholic. She died an alcoholic, which is true. But, you know, it's kind of, there are no coincidences. So, you know, I had had that experience earlier, so, you know, I was willing to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that happened on October 27th of 2003. That's her sobriety date. October 28th is mine. And October 29th, we went to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous together. She was a little resistant because you know, her mom died at 51 years old from this disease. Her mom was a chronic alcoholic, and she had gone through a lot of places, a lot of tried to get help a lot of places, and so my wife didn't believe in Alcoholics Anonymous at first, but she was willing and she came. And what ended up happening was we were welcomed by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous at that meeting and given a where and when and welcome back. And what happened over that first couple of days of meetings, people, married people, were telling us, you need to find separate home groups, which didn't make sense because they were married going to the same group. So that's how you guys do it here. So eventually, she found a home group at Winter Park Group, and that's where she found a sponsor. And I found a home group at the Eastside Club. It was called Another Grateful Day, and it was a morning meeting and met 6 out of 7 days. So there are distinct paths started, hers on her recovery and mine on mine. And you know, the great thing about that is that you know, as I started going to those meetings, I met a guy and he said, listen, you guys probably haven't had any fun in a long time. And 11 days going to meetings, we went to the intergroup gratitude banquet. And I'll tell you, it was so strange because it was at the Hilton in Altamont Springs. Now, in 1994, a year before we got married, on her birthday, we had come over to Universal and spent the whole day getting loaded there and ended up spending the night at the Hilton in Altamont Springs. Now, neither one of us remembered that until that day when we walked into the Hilton for that gratitude banquet and realized that that was the same hotel that we had been in years earlier, loaded. And so we attended that meeting. There's 400 sober alcoholics at that place that night. And Don M. was a speaker, and he gave a great talk. You know, I could connect with everything that man was saying. And it was nice afterwards. I spent a couple of minutes talking with them. And you know, what I remember is that I, you know, outside of being a frightened individual, being around that many sober people, I remember that when he was talking, that I felt a lot of hope coming from you guys. You guys were all laughing, and you looked good, you're all dressed up, and you were having fun, and man, I hadn't experienced that in years. And so flash ahead, I go back, and at my home group, there's this guy that's just getting under my skin on a regular basis, you know. And I asked him one day, I said, I think maybe I'm supposed to ask you, would you be my sponsor? And he just laughed, and he said, let's go inside and talk about that and see what that looks like. And so we did, and, you know, as we went along, he asked me a couple of things. He said, are you willing to go to any length? And I didn't have any clue what that was. I didn't know what that guy was talking about. For no apparent reason, I said yes. And then he said, do you want what we have? And I had no idea, again, what that guy was talking about. But for no apparent reason, I said, yeah. And he said, then, having had this experience, are you willing to help another have that experience? And again, I said, yeah, I didn't know what he was talking about. But he wrote down his phone number and his name, and he said, you call me, and we'll get together. And, you know, for like 3 or 4 days, I was looking at that piece of paper, and he had written 24/7/365, and I didn't understand the code. What is this guy, you know? And finally, after like 4 days, I asked him, what's the thing you put on? And he said, you can call me anytime, day or night, any day of the week, right? Any week of the month, any time of the year. And I thought that was unusual. People have been telling me for a long time to quit calling. And so when I came and he said, you know, you can call me anytime, that was fundamentally different. So that began a journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, get a copy of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I told him I had one, but it was broken. So I traded it in for a new one, new and improved fourth edition. Apparently everybody else was using that, except my sponsor. He was still in the third edition. But, you know, the reason I traded in, my ex-wife had written my name in that third edition, and I didn't want nothing to do with that woman. So he says, you know, read that book. Now, listen, the only time I had ever read anything, I wasn't a big reader, was when I was locked up. Louis L'Amour. And that was as far as I got, you know. And so I'm reading just, I'd read like a sentence or whatever, and maybe a paragraph. It took forever, but he kept saying, how long do you want to stay as sick as you are? And I thought, man, you're a nut. So along the way, a guy at one of the meetings had given me one of them prayer cards from the intergroup. And I called my sponsor. I go, whoa, this guy gave me this card, and it's got these prayers in it. And he said, good. He said, start saying now. I had been praying. He told me to say please in the morning, and if I was sober that night, say thank you, and I could handle that. And so that's the extent of the praying that I was doing. But he said, start praying that third step prayer, and in a week we'll get together. And for the next week, I started reading that prayer card in the morning. I'd do a little bit of that prayer, and I'd get up off my knees, and my head would be just swirling, and I'd like, every day I felt like my life was becoming more and more unmanageable sober than it was drunk. It was crazy. And I'd call him and tell him that, and he'd say, just keep saying that prayer. And he convinced me to take actions that I didn't yet believe in. And at the end of the week, I was really ready to get drunk. I mean, I was convinced life sober was not right. And we got together and did that third step prayer at Jay Blanchard Park. And after doing that prayer, I said, now what? And he said, go read the instructions for doing your four-step inventory. And I said, what the kind of step was that? what was that step? And he said, don't worry about it. Just go read the instructions to write in your inventory. And if you have any questions, call me. So the worst 10 days in Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. The worst 10 days ever in Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's how it goes. Day one, sponsor. Start writing your inventory? No. How long do you want to stay as sick as you are? Well, I don't. We'll write your inventory. Day two. Start writing your inventory yet? No. How long do you... You get the idea. 10 days later, I found the right spiral notebook, the right number two pencil, and began taking action on that four-step inventory list. Now, a friend had given me a tape of Joe and Charlie on the third and fourth step, and kind of put it into Phil language for me. They talked about these basic instincts that were God-given, the sex instinct, the social instinct, the security instinct, how they were God-given and they had a purpose, and they were to be used in the way they were intended to be used. And the problem was is that I had not used them the way they were intended to be used. And so I had a way to do that and to find the truth about that through the process of the inventory. Now, the next 10 days were fascinating, because right in that first column of all the principles, institution, and people, I didn't have resentments. I was pissed. I didn't sit on a bar and tell you who I was pissed at. I never said, I got a resentment against my boss. Never. So I get down exactly who I'm angry with, and that doesn't seem to take but a couple of nights, spending a couple of nights, and I get up in the middle of the night, and I get up and I go watch TV, and then I go, oh no, and I turn it off, and I go sit at my kitchen table, and I do inventory. And then a couple of nights of writing out the cause. I mean, for 20 years, I could sit on a bar stool and tell you exactly how they had wronged me. And so I got that down. And then the next part was to find out, exactly what part of self was harmed, where was I harmed? In which one of those, was it my social, my security, my sex things? Where was I harmed? And I could write that out. And then to get down and see, setting aside everything she had done, they had done, disregarding them entirely. What? I mean, that was insanely hard. I mean, that took a lot, because it was the yeah buts. Every time I look at it, and I go, yeah, but, and I go, oh, yeah. To entirely disregard the other person. And to get down and see where I was to blame, where I was at fault, where I was wrong. The harms that I had done others. The truth about myself, Bill talks about the truth of the stock in trade, and that's, it was eye-opening. So after 10 days, I had it done. I was done. I had written a lot. Haven't written that much since then, thank God. And that's how it's supposed to work. So I called my sponsor and I says, listen, I'm done with my inventory. I'd like to get together with you. And he says, that's fine. He says, I'm busy tomorrow. We'll have to do it the day after. Now, I had heard from you guys that fifth step, if I didn't do it, I might drink again. And I kind of was serious about not drinking again. And I didn't think a day waiting on this stuff would be a good idea. But I set it up with them, and then it dawned on me that I had that friend, that minister that had suggested Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called him. He said, come on down. And I went down there, and he said, listen, meet me in the room down the hall and we can go over this. I said, how about meet me at the pavilion out back, you know, where the picnic tables are? And he goes, okay. See, I didn't want any microphones or hidden recordings. So he said he'd meet me out there, and I went out there, and I knelt on my knees on that concrete, and I asked God to help me be honest and tell this man everything that I was supposed to tell him, that I might be able to be free of this stuff that's been blocking me once and for all. And he came out, and I did that, and then he started asking me questions. So an hour and a half later, he starts asking me questions after I've gone through all this inventory with him. He starts asking, and I was upset. I was like, hey, I didn't read anything about that in the book. But if you read the 12 and 12, it does say that the person might have comment or counsel on that stuff. 12 and 12. Anyhow, next day I get together with my... Oh, so I leave there, and I'm going home, and I'm thinking... Oh man, immediately two things pop in my head and they're not on my inventory. Well, he had told me he was doing his rounds at the hospital because that's what ministers do sometimes. And so I'm fighting with myself, 7 mile distance between meeting with this guy in my house, and you know, it's just going through and oh, that's not a big deal. Oh, you better call him, you know, you might drink again. Oh, you know. So I get home and I call where I know he's not going to be at the church, and the secretary goes, no, he went to do his rounds. I go, well, she goes, do you have his cell phone number? And I go, oh, yeah. He was calling me on his cell phone, so I did. And he answered, and I said, hey, I know you're at the hospital doing your... And he goes, no, I'm at home. Why don't you call me on my home phone? See, that guy knew more about our fifth step than I could have ever imagined. So I shared those couple of things with him. He said, it's not easy, is it, Phil? And I said, no, it certainly hasn't been. And he told me it was all right, you know, to go on and include that stuff as I went and did that 8-step list. And so the next day I meet with my sponsor. Now the difference between doing it with this guy who's not an alcoholic and a minister and doing it with my sponsor is about 2.5 more hours. Because my sponsor wants to start sharing stuff that he's done as an alcoholic, right? And now all of a sudden I'm feeling like I'm not alone. I'm connected with this guy. And after doing that, you know, he and I part ways, and he says, take that hour, you know, and reflect. And the most powerful hour of Alcoholics Anonymous was sitting, looking, and reviewing everything that I had done, and then turning to that page in the big book and reviewing the work. Was it solid? And it said, can I answer to my satisfaction? Because my sponsor has no clue. He's got no clue whether my inventory is solid or not. Only I do. Only God does. And to be able to answer yes was awesome, right? So now armed with that, I get together with him, and we do that 7-step prayer. And I remember he told me to read that prayer, and we get together and do it. And I call him, I said, well, why am I giving God the good also? And he said, well, you never used that right either, you know, in that prayer, you know. And so we get together and we do that prayer, and then he says, you know, make out your list, and he says, number them 1, 2, 3, how you're going to make those amends, you know, the ones you're going to do right away, and then the next ones and the ones to follow. Nowhere in there were amends that I wasn't going to be able to do. He made it clear that I was going to be able to make all those amends, and he was right. So had an opportunity. The first amends I got to do was before I even got together with my 8-step list with him, my mom came to town for a week, and he said, take that opportunity when she's there to make amends with her, and I did. And I sat on my back porch for about an hour and a half, and I made amends with my mother, and at the end, she asked, do you think I'm an alcoholic? I said, well, no, I can pretty much clearly define you as not an alcoholic. The better question is, why? I said, why, my whole life, would you drink a drink and then maybe get another one and then at the end of the night pour it out? Why? And she said, well, I have that first drink and I start feeling kind of good, kind of loosened up. And then she said, and maybe I get into that second drink and I feel like I'm losing control and I don't like that feeling. And I go, oh, Mom, to be an alcoholic, you got to drink right through that. And so then she questioned me about my oldest brother. Now, we don't claim anybody to be an alcoholic or not. And she asked me about him. He's 60 years old. He's still angry about getting second chair trumpet instead of first chair trumpet in fourth grade. I said, he's got all the earmarks as far as I know. I says, but if he is, that's normal. And she just looked at me and she said, that is not normal. And I said, Mom, if I take that to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and tell that to my friends that are real alcoholics, they go, absolutely, that's normal if he's an alcoholic. So, you know, the gift is healed relationships, and I got to heal those relationships through amends. I got to make amends to that ex-wife of mine, and when I did, I wrote this thoughtful letter, as our book says, because 3,000 miles, and she was remarried and had kids, and had my sponsor look it over. I think all my amends have been under the direction of my sponsor and in communication with them so as not to make further harm, and I think it's a good policy to do it that way. It's worked well for me. He said, looks good, go ahead and send it off. And I said, yeah, I'm going to put my mom's return address on it. He goes, what? I go, yeah, I'm going to put my mom's return on it. He goes, why? I go, well, he goes, well, why don't you give her a chance to respond? I go, exactly. I don't want her knowing where I'm at. He goes, well, if it was me. Now, my sponsor has never told me what to do. He suggested what he would do. And he said, what I would do if it was me is I'd give her a chance to respond if she wanted to. 3 more days of praying. Anyhow, I put my return address on it. And it's funny because I mailed it off, and it was 2004. Hurricane Charlie came through, took out the power and everything in the neighborhood. And I had mailed it off the Thursday, the 12th, and Charlie hit the 13th. And then a week to the day, the power came back on, and I went to the mailbox, and there it was. And I was like, oh, no. She responded. So I opened the letter, and by the time I got from the mailbox to my front door, I had another resentment. Now, here's what happens. She says, I've been telling my family I'd be getting this letter for 12 years. Now, I'm praying her dead for 12 years, and she's telling her family one day I'm going to make amends to her. I didn't see that coming. I don't know how she could have. But she said that there had been a lot of counseling when we were married and afterwards, and that she was happily married now and had kids and all that. And if I really wanted to make amends, stay in AA and do what this is a part of making amends to her still tonight. But she recognized, she said, and through all that, I found out that I had a part in it. And I was like shocked. I was like, oh no. She goes, yeah, I married you. So I'm not even from the mailbox to the front door, and I got a resentment. I'm on the phone calling my sponsor, and he's laughing. That's like they always do. Me at the club, let me see the letter. And so he looks at it. Now, here's what sponsors can do. He looks at it in a different kind of way. He says, listen, she grew up in an alcoholic family, right? So long before you ran into her, she had some problems probably, and you have no part of that. Now, from the time you met her to the time you left her, you're responsible for all that. And that's what your amends were about. He said, so now you've done what you're supposed to do. You've cleaned up your side of the street. Right? So, you know, the fact is whatever she has or hasn't seen is on her. And, you know, from that day to this day, I've been free of not praying my ex-wife dead. At times when I've thought of her, I've prayed that she might seek and do God's will. That's all. I got no idea what God's got in store for her. But I tell you, those thoughts that I used to have were shifted only through the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Only through asking the God to enter into my life in a way that I thought was inconceivable. So I get to make the rest of these amends. You know, one was to an ex-boss that I owed a lot of money to, and you know, I called him, and he said, I have no clue who you are. Now, prior to calling this guy, my sponsor, I called him, and he said, don't argue with him. And I said, well, I wasn't going to argue with him. So when I call him, he goes, I don't know who you are. And I go, so I'm trying to explain to him how important this is. And he's like, no, seriously, I don't remember you. And I'm like, I know that I owe this guy a couple of $1,000. There's no way he cannot not remember me. But I don't argue with him. So eventually he goes, listen, it's really clear that it's real important to you that you do this. But I swear, I don't remember. I remembered his fiance's name, his son's name. He said, here's my address. If you want to send me a check for a couple $100, that'd be fine. And I said, listen, if you ever figure out who I am and decide that it's a lot more than that, like I think it is, I'm willing to stand ready to make good on what I owe you. Your money, not mine. Sent him the check, he cashed it. Never heard another word from him. What I got out of that is there are some people that are glad that I'm out of their life. Right? They're just happy not even knowing that I exist anymore. But he gave me that opportunity. You know, through the process of making amends, I got to become a son to my mother. You know, I got to become a brother to my sister and to my brothers. You know, I got to become an uncle to my nieces and nephews. You know, that's what this deal's about, relationships. And it's all because of a relationship with that God. A God that, you know, I know for a fact entered into my heart and my life in a way which is indeed miraculous through these 12 steps. You know, on a daily basis, I live with another alcoholic in good standing. And like I told you, she's way more sober than me. And so we have this 10th step. Promptly admit when we're wrong. And man, if you live in a house with another alcoholic, you know. They're sitting there going, I got time available later. You know what? So we'll go to any length not to have to make amends. But, you know, I think that making amends promptly, you know, cleaning that stuff up right away is important in my life today. I don't want any of that stuff blocking me the way it always blocked me with that relationship with the Creator and ultimately with that relationship with you guys. You know, in the 12 and 12, Bill writes this little thing about this. When we do this inventory, self-analysis, you know, when we do this inventory and then logically interwoven with prayer and meditation, it creates this unshakable foundation for life, you know. And I don't know any other way around it. You know, when I was drinking, I had no way to match serenity with the calamity going on. I didn't. And to this day, I don't. You know, any time that I have that, it's because God's enabled me to have that. Anything, any success I have today is really God's success, not mine. And, you know, I get opportunities all the time to grow through, like I think I experience pain, which keeps me in the process of wanting to grow. Things are going good. You know, that's my perception. You know, I've always put a weight on it. This is a good thing or this is a bad thing. You know, things just are today. And I was promised when I got here that if I did what you guys did, that I'd probably be able to stay sober and that life would become different. And I found that to be 100% true. You know, I know that in knowing that the only time when I'm disturbed, it's 100% of the time something wrong with me. It has nothing to do with you guys. Not 75%, not 60%, 100% of the time. If I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. So the only resource I know from that is immediately seeking God and God's will and calling my sponsor, running it past my sponsor, or talking to another alcoholic. Today I've been given opportunities to help other guys to get sober through the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's crazy. Some of them are sober, you know, and it has nothing to do with me. You know, it's all their willingness and God, right? You know, I've just passed on what's been freely passed on to me, like my sponsor asked me to. And today I get to watch them as they get married, or their marriage gets back together, or their marriage gets back together and they have kids, you know, or they reunite with their kids. One of the greatest opportunities of seeing Alcoholics Anonymous at work was when my wife made amends to that son of hers that she left with his father in Texas. And I knew the day was going to come, and the day came when he responded to her amends. And in an email, she became a mother, a mother-in-law, and a grandmother. And that sounds great for her, but what about me? So I called my sponsor, because I had a problem. And I ran it down, and he said, yeah, remember when you got married and she had to get that divorce from that guy in Texas because she was still married, you know? That's the father, and it's not you. I'm like, yeah, well, how's that helping? He goes, now, remember that guy in Texas, and he's the grandfather, and it's not you? And I'm like, how is this helping? And he goes, hang on, now we're getting to that, because my sponsor sticks with the facts. And he says, now, you're married to Jolene, and Jolene is Johnny's mother, and Colton's grandmother. And he said, now, if that's okay with you, then things will probably be okay, but if not, you got a problem. And in an instant, I realized I had an opportunity to be whatever it was those guys wanted me to be. So she reunited with her son in Fort Walton Beach, and for the first time in 21 years. And I like to carry this picture with me because it's what to me Alcoholics Anonymous is about. This is a picture of my wife and her son for the first time hugging in Fort Walton Beach Airport. The first time in 21 years. And the grandson's in the background. And so, you know, the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is relationships. And they've since had another little boy. And a year ago, we went to Texas, to Galveston, and spent some time with him. Now, my wife had been up to South Dakota to visit him when he was born. He was 6 months old. But I hadn't met the little one yet. And so he was 18 months old, and anyhow. So we're there for a week. And the whole week, the 5-year-old and the one, you know, 18-month-old are following me around, calling me grandpa, grandpa, grandpa. And I'm like, I'm way too young to be a grandpa. My friends have been telling me different for a long time. But what happened was, a week later, I came home and I realized I was a grandpa. You know, because of them, because they decided. And I was like, because of you guys, of helping me to see that it's about relationships, and it's about a relationship with my Creator and a relationship with you guys, and just trying to be a maximum use to you guys and the people about me. That's all I got. Thanks. Thank you.